From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting from Colorado Public Radio in Denver today. This is Here and Now. And in this state, citizens are already voting using mail-in ballots, which went out last week. They can mail them back or drop them off. Although, interestingly, they have to provide their own stamps if they want to mail them back.
Well, Jeremy, early in-person voting kicks off today in a lot of states. Alaska, Wisconsin, some counties in Florida. Donald Trump is in Florida today at Cape Canaveral, St. Augustine, and then Tampa tonight. Hillary Clinton's making one stop today in New Hampshire. The New York Times election forecast gives her a 93% chance of winning the presidency if it were held today. 538's forecast gives her an 86% chance. But today in Florida, Donald Trump said he's winning. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
And yesterday, Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, acknowledged that her campaign is behind. But then, as we said, here's Trump this morning. He was at a roundtable discussion with farmers in Palm Beach County.
I think we're going to win Florida big. So I actually think we're winning. And what they do is they show these phony polls where they, you know, where they look at Democrats and it's heavily weighted with Democrats. And then they'll put on a poll where we're not winning. And everybody says, oh, they're not winning. It's a heavily weighted poll with Democrats.
Ron, what do you think is going on in the Trump campaign right now? What's the goal?
And Kellyanne Conway is acknowledging what the great average of all polls is showing, which is that Hillary Clinton has a lead somewhere between 4 and 8 points. And, of course, some of those polls at the high side are now in double digits. And when you average in some of the polls that are friendlier to Donald Trump, and without even getting into any of the methodologies of all that, just taking them all together, the average is running between 6 and 8 points. So Kellyanne is obviously acknowledging that. Donald Trump doesn't want to acknowledge that because when he gets a hold of his Twitter device and gets his machine cranked up or when he's talking to a crowd, that's not really an applause line. That's not really an enthusiasm builder. So instead of acknowledging what pretty much everybody else in the Trump campaign has acknowledged, he sees fit to say that these polls are phony. Yeah. The polls all across the board, even the average of all of them, is misleading. It's phony. It's overly weighted with Democrats. Now, if there are more Democrats in the weighting of the polls, that is to say in the number of people who are polled, that would have to do with the fact that there are more Democrats than there are Republicans,
yeah,
especially in some states.
Well, meanwhile, the Democrats are looking down ballot. Politico reporting today that President Obama plans to endorse another 30 Democrats running for seats in the House. Now, they need 30. That's a huge number to take back control of the House, now controlled by Paul Ryan and the Republicans. But how unusual is that for a president to extend himself like that down ballot?
The president is focusing here because at this juncture, he doesn't think Hillary Clinton needs that much more of his help. The Senate candidates perhaps do not need as much of his help. And because he can bring a lot more attention to their races, it's really hard for House members or for House challengers to get much attention in the midst of a presidential campaign. So he's trying to bring more attention to them.
Okay. And what about early voting? Began more than a month ago in some places. We heard about ballots. The in-person is starting. Democrats have traditionally dominated early voting. What does it mean this time?
It's more popular than ever. More people are finding out about it. It adds days and times when more people who might have trouble getting to the polls on election day, where the lines are long on election day. The great beauty of early voting is oftentimes you can just cruise on in. You can just come in, sign in, show your registration, and bingo, you're voting, and you don't have to wait in line for 2 or 3 or 4 hours, which is a tremendous disincentive to people voting. And that's been a problem for Democrats, especially in states where they don't set up enough polling places.
Right, but if it's in person, question that I heard from a listener, does that mean that there's exit polling? In other words, does that mean that you might have more results in before the actual day, and that might impact the actual election day?
Some people believe we are not going to know what's in these ballots. They're not going to announce that. They're not going to open these ballots, either from the mail or from the early voting. All we can say is that we see more people showing up who are registered in one party or the other.
Yeah.
So we can say that more Democrats are voting or more Republicans are voting. We don't know for whom they're voting. So some of the Republicans might be voting for Hillary Clinton. Some of the Democrats might be voting voting for Donald Trump. Yeah. So we don't really know, and it isn't really a huge pre-indicator, although it will get folded in to some of the predictive models on the day of Election Day and contribute to how early a call might be made on election night.
Yeah. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, also known as Papa Ron. We will link you to his terrific explanation, complete with Masterpiece Theater music, on yesterday's weekend edition of the 2000 elections. That'll be at herenow.org. Ron, Papa Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, it feels like forever ago in this campaign, but remember when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump released plans to change the way childcare works in this country? Well, Aaron Mozell of Here Now contributor WHYY dug deep into the candidates' proposals and has this report on what they'd mean for struggling parents.
Coconut.
It's just after 6 o'clock, dinner time at Michi Hunt and John Moskis' house in South Philadelphia. 3-year-old Nori is digging into a coconut yogurt and some baby carrots. Her 4-month-old sister, Aiko, has already filled up on milk. The adults are having sausage, red peppers, and rice at some point.
I really would love for us to, like, have this moment where we all sit down, but it's mostly, like, getting her fed, and then we try to get her to bed, and then we can eat. And this one she can eat anytime, so.
Besides, they have bigger fish to fry when it comes to raising their daughters, like paying for childcare for both. Hunt says that eats up nearly a third of their annual household income. The couple brings home roughly $70,000 after taxes.
It's jaw-dropping. Like, we both have a college degree. We both have jobs, reasonably good jobs. I'm not doing something outrageous.
Nori goes to daycare full-time, 5 days a week. Aiko goes for 3. To make it work to pay for childcare and everything else, the mortgage, groceries, clothes, Hunt and Moska do what you'd expect. They pinch pennies.
With one, it really, really squeezed us financially. With two, it feels like, you know, like we're stealing, what is it, borrowing from Peter to pay Paul? Like, you're sort of like, oh, well, we're just going to rack up some credit debt. I mean, there's no two ways about it.
Hunt and Moska aren't alone. In many states across the U.S., childcare is the single biggest expense for families, more than rent and nearing or surpassing college tuition at a public university. Carol Austin is executive director of the Delaware Valley Association for the Education of Young Children. She says that's a big problem.
For me, it's at a breaking point. I know it's at a breaking point here in Pennsylvania. I dread to think that we'll start just warehousing kids.
Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have plans to make childcare more affordable. Clinton says she wants to help parents by improving the country's childcare system. Here she is at a campaign stop in Kentucky covered by Fox News.
They're working to support their families, but a lot of the stress is because it's so expensive on childcare that they don't feel like they're putting anything away for later education. So we'll deal with that on getting to, you know.
Under Clinton's proposal, the cost of childcare would be capped at 10% of a family's income. For Hunt and Moska, that means they'd only pay roughly $7,000 a year. Hunt says they currently shell out $24,000.
It would be amazing. That would be great. Even better would for it to be free.
Donald Trump wants to allow parents to deduct the cost of childcare from their taxes.
Because of the way the benefit is capped and structured, our plan will bring relief to working and middle-class families. Importantly, our policy also supports mothers who choose to stay at home and honors and recognizes their incredible contributions to their families and to our society.
Trump wants to give parents the ability to scrap the full amount of child care from their federal income taxes. That total can't be more than the average cost of care in your state. After getting some flack for not addressing poor families, his plan now includes an earned income tax credit for low-income families. They wouldn't benefit much from an income tax deduction because they're not putting up a lot of income to begin with. Trump's plan would bring down Hunt and Moska's annual child care costs a few thousand dollars to roughly $21,000 a year. Jamie Hopkins is a professor at the American College of Financial Services. He says neither plan will make child care significantly cheaper for anyone who is struggling to afford it now.
That's still going to be a burden, whether these plans are in place or not. But again, it might help ease some of that burden.
Hopkins' point rings especially true for low-income parents like Stacey Booker. She lives just north of Philly in Ambler with her 2-year-old daughter, Leia. Booker is a single mom and brings home roughly $1,400 a month after working 2 part-time jobs. One is at a senior home, the other at a rehab center. Booker is technically living above the poverty line, but not by much.
It's extremely hard. Sometimes I'm surprised I don't have a nervous breakdown, or I'm not strung out on hardcore drugs, or I'm a severe alcoholic.
Child care for Leia is subsidized, but it still accounts for up to a third of Booker's monthly income, depending on the time of year. She's working towards a nursing degree, but school's out in the summer. She doesn't get the subsidy on days she's off work and school, but...
You really have to weigh your options, but then again, it's like you really have no choice because you have to pay your mortgage to have a place to live, but then I have to pay for child care in order for my daughter to be... in a school environment and for me to be able to go to work and go to school.
Experts say neither Trump nor Clinton's plan would be cheap or easy to implement, at least with the details out now. Jamie Hopkins, the finance professor, says while they're expensive, both plans are realistic. That has parents across the country feeling hopeful that their budgets could be a little less stressed, even if their days are still hectic. For Here and Now, I'm Aaron Moselle.
We're here in Colorado for our election road trip, and the polls here, on average, give Hillary Clinton an 8-point lead over Donald Trump, according to Real Clear Politics. That's a big change from the end of September when they were neck and neck. But since then, we've had the debates and the Access Hollywood tape of Donald Trump and Billy Bush. The support that Donald Trump has in Colorado doesn't come from the political establishment. In fact, in the last couple weeks, Republicans drafted a letter in support of Donald Trump, and only 19 of the 49 Republicans in the Colorado legislature signed it. We reached out to a number of Colorado's Republican office holders to talk to us about Trump, and none of them accepted our invitation. Congressman Mike Kaufman, who's in a tough re-election fight, has shown his distaste for Trump, even putting out an ad against the candidate back in August.
People ask me, what do you think about Trump? Honestly, I don't care for him much, and I certainly don't trust Hillary. I'm a Marine. For me, country comes first. My duty is always to you. So if Donald Trump is the president, I'll stand up to him, plain and simple.
Then there's Republican Senator Cory Gardner, who once called Trump a buffoon. Here he is in April responding on Fox News to the accusations by Trump that the Colorado election process was rigged after his loss in the caucus.
The bottom line is this. Donald Trump goes into meltdown when he doesn't get his way. In this case, he lost 34 delegates that he could have won had he participated in the process, had he had an organization. Look, Colorado is not taken by celebrity or flash. It's taken by workhorses, and Ted Cruz proved...
In August, Gardner reluctantly supported Trump, saying a Republican president will make a difference, even a Republican president named Donald Trump. But following the release of that 2005 tape, Gardner called on Trump to step aside and let Mike Pence become the nominee. Republican Senate candidate Darrell Glenn has gone back and forth on Trump. Here he is during a Senate debate on October 11th.
I grew up in a family with domestic violence, so anybody that actually puts a hand on or talks about women in that way, it's painful. But what you saw on Sunday, you saw an individual that actually made an apology. I'm a deep man of faith, and I think it's extremely important that if somebody makes an apology, my faith teaches me grace, mercy, and respect.
Glenn now says he will vote for Trump but won't endorse him. So as you can hear, Republicans in office in Colorado have been tepid at best in their support of Donald Trump. But what about voters? We met up with 2 Trump supporters in Boulder, Susie Littman, who's lived here since 1957.
Stay-at-home mother, volunteer, raised children, you know, sat there in the afternoon with cookies and when they came home from school. So have pretty close to enough hours for a master's degree in anthropology. What else do you want to know?
What about politically over the years? Have you always...
Well, I lived in Boulder in the 1960s, so I was very liberal at that point. And once I started raising children, somehow conservatism became important.
Hmm. And so have you voted Republican in the past several elections? Or...
Yes, I have.
The other Trump voter with us is Jane Maher, who moved here from Illinois 5 years ago.
At that time, I was changing from Democrat to Republican. I realized after the Obama election, whom I voted for, that I didn't like the way the country was going. And ever since then, I've become sort of a student of conservatism and feel more and more strongly that conservatism is an absolute important element and part of our country.
When you say you didn't like the way the country was going, what do you mean by that?
Well, initially, when Obama said elections have consequences, it made me believe that his campaign had been very deceitful, because that was not how he campaigned. And then as he started trying to pass during those first several years, Obamacare and cap and trade and several other things, I realized that he was going in a direction that was not about the conservative principles.
And you thought that he would be about conservative principles?
Well, even though I knew that he wasn't about conservative principles, I believed that he would be working very hard to bring people together. And I found him to be very off-putting, very divisive. I thought his words were very much we versus they. And from then on, I really have watched his manner and his actions, and I have felt that they've been very divisive towards our country.
So what attracted you to Donald Trump?
Well, Donald Trump was not my first choice. And in fact, I would say he was very low on the scale of when we had 17 candidates running. However, I think that once I realized that there was a likelihood that he would get the spot, the Republican nomination, I felt like I better learn more about him. So I started going to the trouble of reading more about his platform, what he was about, what he was proposing, whether it was with the economy, with immigration, with international trade and the military. And I really found that I really agreed with a lot of what he was saying. I don't necessarily agree with how he says it, but I felt that the concepts of what he was preaching were very important.
Susie, you smiled when she said she doesn't agree necessarily with how he says it. Tell us about your feelings about Trump.
Well, part of the appeal of Donald Trump is that he is an outsider, and part of his appeal may very well be that he does not speak like a polished, practiced politician.
Do you like that about him?
I don't either like it or not like it myself. I'm used to listening to politicians who have all their talking points at the ready, written. They don't even have to write it on the back of their hands. They just know it by rote. And I think that that is the way Hillary sounds, the practiced talking points that are repeated over and over, and those are almost all antithetical to what I believe the direction of the country should be taken in.
So it sounds a little, and correct me if I'm wrong, like you are more attracted to the issues and the ideas that Donald Trump is talking about than the person himself.
Yeah, exactly. I am. And as Jane said, when we listen to his ideas on economics, they make more sense than Mrs. Clinton's. When you listen to his ideas on defense and realize that our military is as bad as it's ever been since World War II, when you look at the problems with immigration. You know, I think his policies attract me much more than his personality. And honestly, I am less caring about any candidate's personality. It's not a popular, well, it shouldn't be a popularity contest. And every so often, I think that if people were banned from TV and the populace had to actually read their speeches and read their policies, the elections, most of them would probably turn out very differently.
What about you, the ideas and the issues versus the man?
I totally agree with that, and I think that's kind of the point I was trying to make before. I feel that the economy is my primary issue. My children, I have three grown sons, they have come to believe that 1% to 2% GDP is normal. It's the new normal. And I absolutely disagree with that. I think that it's become the best we can do under the existing economic plans. I think what Donald Trump, his plans will provide a great opportunity for us to really have a rejuvenation of our economy, high level of growth. He says 4%. It wouldn't surprise me if it would be 5 or 6%. When that happens, a lot of the other issues get disappear. When that happens, there's less income inequality. There's fewer people on food stamps. You start to have more and more opportunities for people to increase their own personal wealth. And therefore, I think that the outcome is far better for the entire country.
What do you think about the fact that so many Republicans in Colorado are not supporting Donald Trump?
I think that's because once a politician gets into the political world, and by the way, our founders never intended to have a permanent political class, and I think there are an awful lot of politicians who don't want to see their apple cart upset.
That, and also there, he's said a lot of things that have offended certain people. Have you been, has anything that Trump has said so far made you question your decision to support him?
I'm 73 years old, and by now I know, I think, what men talk about when they're by themselves. And I think if I'm going to be conservative, which I am, about this, I would say that 80% of the men in this country have said things just as egregious as Donald has, but they say it behind closed doors or in the, you know, locker room. And no, as long as people don't do it publicly in front of small children, I don't care what they talk about in private.
What about you?
I really don't pay attention to those things, and I look at the issues and I look at the solutions that are being proposed for that.
Do you think Trump's going to win?
Absolutely.
Do you think so?
I'm not sure. I certainly hope so.
That was Susie Littman and Jane Maher of Boulder, Colorado, two Trump supporters. Tomorrow, we'll hear from the state's Democratic governor, John Hickenlooper, who's supporting Hillary Clinton.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
There's been a lot of reaction to AT&T's proposed $85 billion purchase of Time Warner. Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken said it's raising flags. Consumer groups are readying strategies to block it. But why? If it goes through, what will it mean for consumers? Jill Schlesinger is here. She's a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So, Jill, to remind people, AT&T is the distributor. Time Warner produces content like HBO and CNN. Both say their merger will mean lower prices for consumers. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know. Whenever I hear merger and the promises of lower prices, they rarely come into fruition. There's a lot of unknowns with this deal, and certainly the Department of Justice is going to weigh in. And the big question is, how will non-AT&T customers be affected? Will they have to pay more for the content they've come to know? Will they be forced to switch providers or simply go without? And frankly, how will this also affect some smaller competitors who other businesses who may be serving a lot of customers in areas where we don't see a lot of competition?
Yeah, so a Verizon customer who wants to watch HBO, you're saying there's some concern that AT&T could restrict it or charge more for it?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the concern. I don't actually think that's what's going to happen. If we think of the world of economics or business as carrots and sticks, that would be quite a stick, right? We're going to bash you over the head. If you really want to see Game of Thrones, Verizon people, you're going to have to pay up for that. I don't think that regulators are going to like that approach. But I could see an approach where it becomes more appealing to switch over to AT&T because maybe you'll get more robust content. Maybe you'll get some extras. And maybe you'll get some benefits that you might not see by staying with Verizon. That could be the inducement or the carrot that is used. I think that the approach for this transaction would have to be, in order to get the deal passed, to say, oh, no, no, we're going to give people lots of options. If they'd like to opt in, we'd love to have them over here, but we're not going to penalize you by not being our customer.
Yeah. Well, staying with consumers, Randall Stephenson, CEO of AT&T, says that with this merger, AT&T would be able to give additional data to Time Warner and to advertisers about what people are watching. What is he referring to there?
Well, I am very frightened about that, because that could mean that I have very specific ads that are targeted at me, whether it's because of where I am or what I watch. That might be confusing for many advertisers. But look, this is just one of those ways that we see that the entire advertising world is transitioning. I had a very large ad executive say to me, we are entering into a time where, you know, not only are you going to get content that seems to be curated for you, but you will get advertisements that are very distinct to you. And that could really mean that you're watching a TV show on a streaming device and you get a different commercial than the person watching next to you. That's kind of weird. It's a little bit freaky, but maybe, especially if you're under the age of 35, you're willing to think that that's a fabulous thing as long as it keeps your costs down. People who are over the age of 35, there does seem to be a generation gap around comfort with that notion.
Well, and some people might be happy with, you know, if not only this, the cost going down, but just send me the ads that you think I'll want to see. But it reinforces, it keeps us all in the same bubbles we seem to be getting into. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money on the proposed AT&T and Time Warner merger, which is going to take a long time if it happens. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
I'm broadcasting from Colorado Public Radio in Denver today as part of our election road trip. Denver is the fastest growing big city in the country. Last year, the population here jumped almost 3%, and you can feel that growing population when you drive. The traffic can be abysmal. Drivers here spent an average of 49 hours in traffic last year. 20 years ago, they spent just 31 hours, which is why Denver has been investing in this.
So back in 2004, Denver Metro voters approved a substantial tax increase to build out this rail system called Fast Tracks.
That's Ken Schreppel, a professor of urban planning at the University of Colorado, Denver. He says Fast Tracks, which has expanded the rail system here to 53 stations, with more on the way, is a start. But Denver will need more to keep up with the population growth.
If you look at any great city, there's kind of two tiers of transit that that city would have. Take, you know, Paris, for example. You have the Paris Metro, and then you have the RER, which provides the commuter rail. In New York City, you've got the, you know, the commuter rail lines, and then you have the MTA, the subway system. So here in Denver, Fast Tracks and these regional rail lines represent kind of that commuter scale, suburbs to downtown type transport, which we do need. What we're really missing, though, is the intra-city transit that will allow people to be able to get around the city and from neighborhood to neighborhood without having to drive.
Do you expect that Denver will ever have that kind of thing, like a subway?
Well, whether it's a subway or not, you know, the technology or the mode is yet to be determined. But whether it's streetcars, more light rail, enhanced buses, bus rapid transit, there's a variety of transit technologies out there. And probably what we'll end up doing is a mix of those. But the city of Denver right now is just starting a planning process to envision exactly what that kind of intra-city transit system would look like.
That planning process is called Denverite, and it's being led by Chrissy Fanganello. She's director of transportation and mobility for the city of Denver, and she spends a lot of her time thinking about Denver's growth.
Yeah, Denver's growing very quickly, and it's not just Denver proper, but it's the entire region that's growing. And one of the things that we're really thinking about is not only how do we do this from the address this from a transportation perspective, but also from the place building perspective. So that's why we're engaged in this Denverite process right now, to talk about mobility and parks and recreation and land use, and how do all those things play together.
Perhaps the best example of all those things playing together is Denver's newly renovated Union Station, a train hub that has helped revitalize an area near downtown called Lodo. While diners eat at upscale restaurants at street level, passengers down below make their way to trains on some of the city's new lines. Chrissy Fanganello says she hopes to double the amount of people using transit in some areas.
What percentage of the population of this area do you need to be taking buses, trains, whatever, in order to keep the traffic at a manageable level?
So it really depends. In Denver proper, like folks that are coming into and out of downtown on a regular basis, almost 50%, 45, 50% of folks are coming into and out of downtown by transit, which is great. We've got other sections of the city that are sort of employment centers that don't have this, quite the same rich transit that we do here in downtown. So it's trying to understand like what's happening in different regions of the city versus what's happening overall. And many times it's more competitive to drive your car from a time perspective, which is what people value a lot of, rather than to take transit or to ride a bike or walk or take a bus.
Or take an Uber or a Lyft, which Ken Schreppel says are helping in their own way.
It's part of the what we call in planning kind of the first last mile solution. If you do take transit to get to where you're going, sometimes that transit station is still, you know, it's not directly in front of where you need to go. It's maybe a mile or two away.
But Chrissy Fanganello says Uber and Lyft also add to traffic, including right in front of Union Station, where many people like to be picked up and dropped off.
I think it's providing people different mobility options, which I think is great. That's what we want to have people, you know, use those choices. So we're always supportive of that. One of the things that we're curious to understand, like, is what they're seeing actually less traffic, less cars on the road, or is there an increase in the cars on the road? So really trying to think about what are the outcomes we're seeking, not only from a place-building perspective, but also from an environmental and a sustainability perspective.
About an hour north in the Front Range near Boulder, growth is being felt in different ways. More and more houses are being built closer to the forest and closer to the danger of forest fires. One hit 6 years ago, destroying 168 homes. We met two researchers from the University of Colorado on a mountain road surrounded by the charred remains of pine trees from that fire. And Kristen Averett and Jeff Lucas had a warning. Climate change will bring more fires, and population growth will bring more homes into harm's way.
It exemplifies a trend that we've seen in the last 20 years towards more frequent, larger, more severe fires in ponderosa pine. And in part, it's come at a time when we've had a warming trend. The state of Colorado is a couple degrees warmer Fahrenheit than it was 30 years ago. That's definitely been a contributing factor. We also have more people living in these mountain environments, and there are more ignition sources. We've been suppressing fire in these forests for a long time. And so we've got multiple factors, climate change being one of them, that has tipped the scale towards more frequent and more severe fire in right close in to the heavily urbanized Front Range, and in right in these areas that, while not urbanized, are what we call the wildland-urban interface. And so you've got at least hundreds of houses within a fire footprint of anywhere from hundreds to thousands of acres.
What about drought? Have you had to deal with that more than before?
So since 2000, we've been in a drier period of weather in Colorado and across much of the interior west, including some bona fide severe drought years like 2002, 2012, 2013. 2010 was not one of them, except for the late summer into the fall, and it dried out the landscape just enough that when you had an ignition and a warm day, the Formal Canyon fire took off.
I think it's really important in terms of the relationship between fire and drought and really water and climate change is to really understand that the impacts of climate change primarily will be and are being delivered through changes in the water cycle. And it's that water availability, the connections with drought, the connections with fire. That's a really important point to understand.
What do you mean change in the water cycle? What does that mean?
So what happens is, as Jeff had alluded to, we've warmed in the state of Colorado by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 30 years. Well, when you warm the atmosphere, it can hold more water. So what happens is, because the atmosphere can hold more water when it's hotter, it means that you'll have more evaporation. So there's less water that's actually going to remain on the landscape.
So let me put that another way. A warmer atmosphere is a thirstier atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And so we've always had dry years as less precipitation. Drought years with very low precipitation, with a warmer and thirstier atmosphere, the drought impacts are worse than they were before.
You know, we think of people in Florida or New Orleans or some of the coastal areas as really being on the front lines of climate change. I think a lot of people don't think that in the mountains of Colorado this would be an issue, but you're saying it is.
I think we're all on the front lines of climate change. I think it would be a mistake to think otherwise. It impacts everybody so differently. Yes, you live in Florida, you have sea level rise. You live in the Mountain West, then you have issues related to water availability and fire and pine beetle. There are lots of different ways that climate change is manifest across the country.
So add climate change to the list of challenges for a growing region. The governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, has put that issue on his agenda, pushing to expand renewable energy, regulate methane, and increase transparency in the fracking industry. He's also said the state's transportation woes need to be addressed with new sources of funding. And he said something you'll rarely hear a governor say while in the midst of a population boom. He said the state is growing almost too rapidly. Well, one issue we didn't talk about there was housing and affordability. While Colorado's population rose by almost 102,000 people last year, the state added only 25,000 new homes, condos, and apartments, which means the cost of living is going up, home prices have been rising, rents are on the rise, which means many more people are having to move further from the city center, which means more time in traffic. You're listening to Here and Now.
Civil rights and anti-war activist Tom Hayden has died. He was one of the Chicago Seven who organized the anti-Vietnam War protests at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. The world was watching on television as police beat protesters. In the years after, Hayden became a politician, remained a voice against war and for reform of the political system, a voice that went silent yesterday. He'd been in poor health since a 2015 stroke and was in a wheelchair when we spoke at the Democratic Convention in July. First, I want to tell people, you got your Made in Detroit hat on, you got your Hillary button on. Some people would have thought, you know, the progressive Tom Hayden, the activist, the agitator, it would have been Bernie. Was it Bernie at one time?
Bernie and I only have one thing in common that you need to know. We're both politicians, so we make decisions based on what's possible. And my decision was that she was going to get all the African-American and Latino votes and then the women's votes and organized labor, more or less. So why would I turn my back on my friends of a lifetime? You know, I've really been trying to work towards a goal that seems to be getting realized, and that's a serious united front against Trump. And I must say, I'm not one of the people that has a pathological issue about Hillary Clinton. I like Hillary Clinton.
Hold up a second, Tom Hayden. She voted for the war in Iraq. Now, she says she's sorry now, but people on Bernie Sanders' side are saying, why didn't you read the intelligence that showed there was no weapons of destruction? Well, you might have been the protester standing out there with a sign.
She said like 1,000 times she made a mistake, so let's pass on that, for God's sakes.
Okay, well, what is it, do you think, that not just the Democrats, but the Republicans are missing about Donald Trump? I mean, he's appealing to something that the Republican candidates weren't able to appeal to, and the Democrats haven't been able to appeal to. Why do you think it is that he's doing so well? What is the upset?
I think there's three factors. One, 25 years in the public eye as a television actor. Two, economic nationalism.
He's appealing to people who believe that some jobs are going to come back, and they probably aren't, according to
economists. No, they're not coming back. Yeah. So the TPP fight is not over. It's causing a big problem for the Clinton base in Michigan and the Rust Belt. You've got to repair that. But there has to be a way to consolidate and strengthen her opposition to the TPP.
But on the other hand, other people, including economists, have said, no, don't tear this up. We've got to have this kind of trade. It's a global economy.
Oh, no, we're past that.
You are? Because they've said, we've got to retrain people in the Rust Belt so that they can do some of the jobs that there are, engineering jobs. You don't buy that?
The fact is, we've lost these hundreds of thousands of jobs. as a direct result of these free trade agreements. The backup position was always that, well, we'll retrain the losers. And that has proved to be politically problematic for the Democratic Party and a total disaster to hundreds of thousands of people in the world I come from.
Yeah.
The whole process is completely secret, and that's been a pretty hot issue with the CIA and with drones and many issues. But secret money, campaign finance. But I would recommend that people take up transparency as a rejection of secrecy. Mm. That's a starting point.
Just know what the deals behind closed doors are. Tom Hayden.
No, give a voice in those deals.
And then secondly, pass
the infrastructure bill, putting hundreds of thousands of people to work, which I think Bernie and Hillary both agree on.
A big piece in the New York Times recently, the rallying cry for Democrats could be infrastructure. You know, let's just repair things, and there is your jobs program. Tom Hayden.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. We had an interesting conversation with a much younger colleague, and he was asking about the 60s, and some colleagues were filling in of what it was like, and people were worried here about what might happen at some of the protests. This young person said to me, wow, because we were explaining how much violence there was and it's in Chicago, and he said, wow, my friends and I, we thought we were in a movement, but now I'm not sure we are in a movement. Because he's realizing that in the 60s, you really could see it. You could see it on your TV screens. What would you say to that? I mean, does there have to be smoke bombs and police batons for it to be, or is it more happening on social media?
Wait, those are mounted machine guns, not smoke bombs.
I'm talking about 68.
I know.
Yeah.
Mounted machine guns.
Right.
In our face. This week you've had some disorder, but what you've noticed is that the will to demonstrate and speak truth to power with illegal civil disobedience has dissipated because people know that plays into Trump's hands. One other thing that very few people in progressive circles talk about is the inevitable rise of a really very moving and inspirational feminism in the person of the first female president.
That's Tom Hayden, activist, still agitating. Thank you so much. Pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much.
Tom Hayden, last July. He died yesterday at the age of 76. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at Colorado Public Radio in Denver. This is Here and Now.